Welcome back to the Mastering Your Fertility podcast. This show is all about reclaiming health, enhancing fertility, and preparing for pregnancy. I'm Kristen Cornett, a holistic nutritionist and functional wellness practitioner at Tiny Feet.
And I'm Dr. Haley Knight, a naturopathic doctor and certified nutritionist at Synergy Women's Healthcare in Portland, Oregon. Our goal with this show is to educate and empower couples with the knowledge they need to get pregnant, stay pregnant, and have the healthiest baby possible.
Thanks so much for tuning in this week. We appreciate you being here, and we hope that you're able to learn something valuable to help you on your journey. If you're looking for more personalized one-on-one guidance for your health and fertility struggles, you can learn more about working remotely with me, Kristen, by visiting my website at tinyfeet.co, or you can schedule a free 20-minute phone consult now through the link in the podcast episode description. If you're local to the Portland, Oregon area, you can learn more about seeing Dr. Haley in person at her clinic by visiting drhaley.com. We've also created an online course together called Fertile in 5 Masterclass, which walks you through everything you need to know to prepare for a healthy pregnancy. To make this information more accessible during this time of economic uncertainty, Fertile in 5 is currently on sale for more than 50% off the regular price through June 1st, 2020, and you can learn more and get signed up through the link in the episode description. You can also get a preview of Module 3 of the course by checking out the How to Choose the Best Prenatal Supplements online mini course, which is also linked in this week's episode description. You're listening to episode 72, and this is our question and answer session for the month of April. If you missed our last two Q&A episodes, be sure to check out episodes 64 and 68. And of course, we're always looking for more questions to include in upcoming Q&A episodes. So if you have a topic that you've been wanting to learn more about, go ahead and send me an email at info@tinyfeet.co or shoot me a DM on Instagram @tinyfeet.co and share your question. I'll get back to you shortly with an answer and then add your question to the list of potential topics for future Q&A episodes. This week, we're answering questions about our thoughts on conceiving during the COVID-19 pandemic, how to look deeper into issues like chronic yeast infections, clots during your period, facial hair growth, and spotting between periods, how to approach fertility and preconception prep while still breastfeeding, what to do if your period doesn't return after a miscarriage, the best options for bioidentical progesterone, imbalances in T4 and T3 hormones on a thyroid panel, and whether pea protein has any negative impact on fertility. We have a lot to cover, so let's jump right in and get started with our first question, which is, what are your thoughts on trying to conceive at this point in time with COVID-19 happening? Since the research isn't out on how it affects pregnancy, what would your opinion be? Dr. Haley, why don't you start with that one?
Thanks, Kristen. Yeah, this one's pretty relevant at this particular point where we're all just staying home, not only just one little region of the world, but the whole world, it seems at this point, has been put on hold, which is really fascinating.
And weird.
So yeah, very, very weird. I'm sure everyone listening can relate. So I was actually also thinking how interesting it is that half of the world, well, I don't know the exact percentages, but there's a big chunk of the world that's completely on hold and like at home. And then there's a big chunk of the world that is actually working overtime and working very, very, very hard to keep everybody safe. And so their lives have actually been put on speed, hyperspeed, and obviously are risking their lives every day. So if you happen to be one of those healthcare workers on the front lines or even in the grocery stores or gas stations, everywhere else where you're still working, thank you. Thank you. Thank you so, so very much. We appreciate your hard work and dedication. All right. So should you be trying to conceive during this time? I can definitely see why this would be concerning to so many of us out there. So I believe this is going to be a very individualized situation. So it really does depend on how long you've been trying to conceive, what your age is, do you feel like you have time to wait, or do you feel like you want to just be careful, make sure that your immune system is optimized and continue on that trying to conceive journey? So in my particular case, actually, because I am now in the process of trying to conceive. I feel like I've done enough with my particular individualized health situation to feel comfortable moving forward with that. And I'm also in a situation where I'm very isolated. My husband/fiance is very isolated as well, and my child is isolated. So I'm not, you know, out and about and feel like I'm in a situation where I'm exposing myself all the time. So I feel very safe that I'm likely not going to contract this virus. Also, I've been able to recently do a lot of work as making sure that my vitamin D level's up, my iron's up. I've been taking all my prenatal supplements and eating a really healthy diet. I did a few cleanses earlier this year. So ultimately, I just feel even if I did get the virus, I would be okay. However, there is a bit of a risk there because there is no research on, again, like the question stated, on any research on pregnancy outcomes and even birth outcomes. So people might equate this to like, well, what if it's like another Zika thing where the Zika virus is causing these birth defects? We actually have no idea if that's the case. Just keep in mind that Zika is transmitted totally different than the way COVID-19 is. They're different viruses. Zika is transmitted through mosquitoes, and coronavirus is going to be spread through respiratory fluids such as saliva or mucus. So that just means they act differently, and there's a lot of viruses out there that don't have any effect on the pregnancy or pregnancy outcome, outcome of the baby. So, but if you do have time and you are being more exposed, you're out there in the world, you have to go to your job, maybe you work at a grocery store, things that you really are going to be at higher risk for exposure, and you feel like you have the time to go ahead and wait, then I would say it's a good idea to probably wait, you know, take this time to really focus on your health and wait till this whole pandemic is over and maybe until we have more information on what it might do to pregnancy and birth outcomes, and then give it make your assessment at that time.
Yeah, I think that. Yeah, I think that's reasonable for sure. You know, I think in my particular situation, I'm in a similar boat to you, Haley, where it's easier for me to kind of isolate, and my family, it's been easy for them to isolate as well, and so I'm not as concerned personally about getting the virus, but I also am concerned about things like an overwhelmed healthcare system and being able to access the care that I would need if I were pregnant, and, you know, just the economic uncertainty that's happening right now for a lot of people, myself included. You know, my husband is out of work currently with this whole pandemic situation. He works in the service industry, so he's been closed down for a couple of weeks, and it is a stressful and uncertain time, and adding that stress to, especially to the early stages of a pregnancy when we already have a lot of, you know, uncertainty and little worries and anxieties and fears about that stuff. I think that if you have time to wait, that it might be a good idea to wait until we have a bit better idea of how long we're going to be in this state. Obviously, it's not reasonable to shut all of this down forever and to just not have babies for the foreseeable future. I just want to reinforce, though, the fact that if you have recently become pregnant, or you are continuing to actively try to conceive, you know, if you're doing the things that are recommended, your social distancing, good hygiene, you know, supporting your immune system with good sleep and a healthy diet, I don't think you need to be like freaked out or paranoid if you do conceive. I think that's, we don't have the data yet to say what the outcomes are going to be, but the best thing that you can do is to just support yourself in every way that you can. And hopefully the slower pace of life is helping you do that a little bit by being able to spend a little bit more time on some of those self-care items that can really support the immune system. But don't panic, just do everything that you can to support yourself and your immune system, and make sure that you stay as healthy as possible.
Yeah. Good addition there. I totally agree. Okay, so let's go on to the next question. Number two question is, I suffer from chronic yeast infections. Can this affect my ability to conceive? Any tips on how to kick them?
Yes. surprisingly. We actually just had a podcast episode last week with Angela Heap. She's a nutritional therapist in the UK. And that entire episode was about the vaginal and uterine microbiome. And so if you want to learn more about the specific impact on fertility and potentially as well on pregnancy outcomes, you can check out that episode for a more robust discussion on all of the different ways that it can affect things. But you know, that vaginal microbiome is really, it's really kind of the barrier between the outside world and what's actually able to get up into the uterus. And you're supposed to have a kind of a very specific balance of bacteria in that vaginal environment. And when that gets disrupted, it can create a perfect breeding ground, perfect circumstances for yeast to start to overgrow. And obviously that can cause a lot of really frustrating symptoms, especially if you're having them on a continuous basis. Those are super miserable to have, either that or, you know, struggling with something like BV on a regular basis, bacterial vaginosis. And so imbalances in that microbiome are important to get under control, not just for symptoms, but because of how they might potentially impact that environment in the uterus. So as far as how to overcome them, you will definitely want to speak to your personal practitioner to get individualized advice on what's right for you. But I can tell you what Dr. Haley and I typically recommend to our clients and patients. And so one of the first things that you can do to really help your body get these infections under control is to rebalance that pH in the vagina and restore a more acidic pH, which is what it's meant to be, to prevent some of those overgrowths or prevent things from getting up into the uterus. And so one of the ways that you can do that is by considering a round of boric acid suppositories. So these are little capsules that are actually inserted into the vagina, and a 2-week course of those, something like Boracap, which you can find on Amazon. Once again, speak to your practitioner before you take any of this on. But that is something that you can consider doing, a 2-week course of boric acid, and that really helps rebalance that vaginal pH. And that creates a better environment for those really important, super important lactobacillus species to grow and thrive that belong there in the vagina. And that can help your body kick those infections much more easily. Another thing that you might want to consider after going through that vaginal pH rebalancing and getting rid of that initial infection is rebalancing the vaginal microbiome. And you can do that either with oral probiotics that contain certain strains, or you can also insert probiotic capsules into the vagina as a suppository. Just make sure that you're using a really clean supplement that's not full of like fillers or any kind of undesirable ingredients. And since we talked to Angela and learned a little bit more about some of the specific strains that are really good for vaginal health, like the Lactobacillus crispatus and the Gasseri and some of the other ones, I'm actually looking for a good probiotic supplement that includes at least 2 of the 4 of those strains. I haven't found one yet. So stay tuned for that. If I do find one, I'm going to add it to the probiotic recommendations in the How to Choose the Best Prenatal Supplements course. So you might see an addition to that if you're already enrolled in that course. And then depending on what other like gut symptoms or other systemic issues that might be present with a client, if I was seeing somebody one-on-one, I might also recommend something like stool testing to look deeper into the overall microbiome and see whether or not that gut microbiome might be contributing to the vaginal microbiome issues. All of those little bugs in our different areas where we have a lot of bacteria can be related, and we can transfer some of those bugs from one area to another. So it is often important to look at the gut when we see yeast infection or bacterial vaginosis on a regular basis. And then with yeast in particular, dietary changes are also important. Really removing anything from the diet that's going to preferentially feed yeast and pathogenic bacteria. And that's really all the things that we tell you to eliminate anyway for a good preconception and pregnancy diet. So that's going to be like sugars, excess starches, even doing like too many grains in the diet. That's just a lot of starch, and yeast feed on sugars and starches. So it's important to keep those low. Getting rid of processed foods, definitely alcohol. That's a big one to consider as well. Removing alcohol if you're dealing with these types of issues. High yeast foods also might cause some additional symptoms for you. And then make sure that you're focusing on lots of non-starchy vegetables, plenty of high quality proteins, healthy fats. And then if you're looking for a more personalized protocol, definitely talk to somebody that is familiar with addressing these types of issues with their clients or patients. Anything to add?
Yeah, I have a few things to add. I have a very personal story about chronic yeast infections, as you may have heard. And I could probably talk for 4 hours on this straight. But yeah, I think pretty much Kristen nailed the gist of it. I would say one thing that I notice in my practice is that women will often have no idea that they have a vaginal infection because it doesn't present the same in many women. I would think the most common way that it presents, or what people think what it is like itching, discharge, like a burning sensation, or, you know, the white discharge. I think that's pretty common for like yeast infection. But I know, like, so much for my personal situation, when I was struggling with this, unbeknownst to me, is that it was just pain after intercourse, and it would be like an outside burning sensation. And then sometimes I would get itching where I thought that was just normal. But now that I'm better, I know that that was absolutely not normal. And you don't have to, you should not be dealing with like some chronic itching thing that just keeps, you know, maybe it comes and goes. But really, that is a sign that there's an imbalance there. So if you at all feel like there's something that needs to be checked out, even like Lisa Hendrickson Jack, she should be a doctor. That's why. who wrote The Fifth Vital Sign, she talks about a type of infection where there's just like watery discharge. So a lot of watery discharge. And I actually just worked with a patient recently that had that same symptom. And so we started the chronic BV protocol for her, and she's actually getting a lot better. So that could be your only symptom, just excess discharge. And women might think that that's totally normal. And yes, all of that can affect your ability to conceive. And the other thing I was just going to add quickly was that part of the reason why it affects your ability to conceive is because it changes the microbiome even on your cervix, and even your ability for your cervix to make very fertile type of mucus. And so that mucus is supposed to be kind of the sperm highway to get that sperm up into your uterus and up to the top of your uterus so you can, you know, you can get to the egg. And if that fertile mucus isn't optimally functioning, maybe due to this dysfunctional microbiome that's happening, or dysbiosis in your vaginal canal, then that's going to impede sperm from getting into your uterus where it needs to go.
For sure. Yeah. And like we mentioned, definitely check out last week's episode. You might not think that this particular topic applies to you, but I promise that you will learn a ton from that episode.
So pretty fascinating.
Check it out. Yeah. And if you're going through any type of fertility treatment as well, it's a great one to check out. I think there are definitely some implications for this microbiome research to make it into more conventional type of fertility treatments and have that investigated a little bit more deeply with conventional providers. All right. So moving on to question 3, why would my period have become extremely heavy and full of clots after excision surgery for endometriosis?
Yeah, I think this was question 4. So with endometriosis, clots are very common with endometriosis, and a lot of that's due to the estrogen dominance that's happening, or also just the too little progesterone to oppose that type of estrogen that's being created. And so in regards to the clotting after surgery, when they go into the laparoscopic surgery or the excision surgery, they're taking out those endometrial spots that they find outside of the uterus. They're not actually going into your uterus and taking anything outside of your, or taking off spots that are actually inside of your uterus, and because that's where your endometrium is supposed to be. And so as far as clotting goes, I do have kind of a thought process on this, that it probably has something more to do with your liver and the processing of that estrogen and more of the hormonal imbalance, because surgery within itself is very hard on the body. Often, not often, but I would say 100% of the time you're under anesthesia, like general anesthesia. That's very tough on your liver, especially if you're having methylation problems or you're already dealing with, I mean, endometriosis within itself is a chronic inflammatory condition. Your liver is already going to be bogged down by what's going on in your gut and, you know, the actual just disease itself. So after surgery, that's going to be a time where you're going to have to focus more on cleansing the liver, focusing on diet, focusing on rebalancing hormones. You'll want to work with some functional practitioner to be able to do that, to be able to work on the clots in the period, getting that back to like a nice, healthy, bright red kind of blood with no clotting. Another thing I would just add quickly is the Mayan abdominal massage can be really helpful too. Like once you get past that kind of 6 week point of healing after the laparoscopic surgery, and if your surgeon is okay with you doing this and you find a well educated practitioner that does Mayan abdominal massage, that can be really helpful for increasing lymph flow, blood flow, and realigning that uterus into a good spot. Because sometimes when your uterus is misaligned and there's been surgery there and you have adhesions there from the post-surgery, then that can also cause old blood to kind of build up and cause these clottings once you have your menses each month.
Yeah.
That's it. You got anything to add, Kristen?
No, I think that pretty much covered it. Yeah, I think some of all of the things that we would typically consider with endometriosis would be relevant, and they may just be exacerbated, like Dr. Haley said, after going under general anesthesia for surgery. So same things that we would consider for endometriosis, whether excision surgery has happened or not, you know, gut health, liver health, and hormone balancing, as well as that like pelvic alignment and working on reducing adhesions and scar tissue through massage or some other modality.
Yeah. Yeah. I think overall for this person who sent in this question, it's just important to know when they're doing a laparoscopic surgery and excising those lesions, they're not actually going inside your uterus. Like that is, has not been affected. So yeah, maybe that helps answer that a little bit more clearly. Okay. Number five.
Four.
Is there?
Four. I think it's four.
Did I misnumber this wrong? Maybe I did. Oh, I totally did.
It's fine.
Kristen's always right. Okay. We're on number four. It's because I made a last minute edit and it,
added a number,
switched all the numbers on me.
Yep.
Of course it did. Wait, is it April Fool's yet? Or no, that's tomorrow. Well, yeah, it's April Fool's. This goes live. Okay. So, is there Is there a specific progesterone supplement that is cleaner that you guys recommend?
All right. So bioidentical progesterone is obviously going to be ideal. If the purpose of the progesterone supplementation is for fertility, we definitely recommend bioidentical progesterone. That is not always what's recommended during the course of fertility treatment. So if you're in fertility treatment, you're going to be using whatever your doctor is recommending at that point. But if what you're doing is having a conversation with your doctor on prescription progesterone support for fertility, and if you've been confirmed to have low progesterone and you're looking to make sure that you can support the early stages of a pregnancy, bioidentical progesterone is definitely what you're going to want to speak with your doctor about. So there are a couple of different options for this. One is called Prometrium, which is an oral bioidentical prescription progesterone. This is one that's commonly recommended when physicians are prescribing bioidentical progesterone. And it works very well. You can either take it orally or you do have the option to insert it vaginally. And so if this is being prescribed to you, I would take it the way that your doctor recommends you to take it, but either one is technically an option. It does contain peanut oil, so that's important to know for anybody that might have a peanut allergy. That is a pretty common allergy. So if that's you, you will want to seek out an alternative option. And that alternative option what I would recommend, what I would personally use for myself, is to get vaginal suppositories from a compounding pharmacy that does bioidentical hormone products. And so if you're looking for a compounding pharmacy near you, you should be able to find that information with just a quick Google search, or you can search like bioidentical compounding pharmacy near zip code, wherever you are. And so you should be able to find out what is available at that pharmacy. You may need to call and ask about like ingredients or preparation, specific dosages that are available. A lot of conventional OBGYNs don't typically prescribe products that have to be ordered through a compounding pharmacy. So as much information as you can get in advance to be able to bring to your doctor and kind of advocate for what you would like to have, the better off you'll be. So those would be my two recommendations. Dr. Haley, do you have other suggestions?
No, I totally agree. I actually prescribe Prometrium a lot. I don't see any big obstacle to using Prometrium, except for the peanut oil situation that you definitely mentioned. That is a concern. I also have sent a lot of progesterone prescriptions to compounding pharmacies as well. So there's different ways. The cool thing about compounding pharmacies is they really are like little magicians and they could just do whatever they want, you know, they're like little witches and they put
safely with it. All,
yeah. So you can really, your doctor can request, you know, any type of, if you wanted it to be in cream form, or it, maybe you want it to be more ointments absorbed, or anyway. But yeah, there are specific, more standard type of products like the suppository that Krista mentioned. And then also you can get a kind of like a Prometrium, but it's, it doesn't have any of the additives and it doesn't have any of the peanut oil in it. So that it's like micronized progesterone just in a capsule form that you can insert vaginally as well. And compounding pharmacies will do that too. The cool thing about compounding pharmacies as well is that you can modify the dosage to what works for you. So let's say you wanted to do like 125 milligrams of progesterone. Don't ask me why you'd want to do something like that, but maybe you would. So this is probably more relevant with other hormones like testosterone and estrogen and things like that. But yeah, so pretty much you nailed it, Kristen.
Thanks. All right. Moving on to question five. Can you address the health aspect of getting pregnant while breastfeeding? How many months should you wait before getting pregnant after breastfeeding? What nutrients should you be focusing on before conceiving? And also, kind of a bonus question, is there an ideal month of conception for the healthy baby? So this is kind of like four questions.
That's one. Exactly. That is definitely four questions.
The person who got this answer got like quite a few bonus points in here. Getting it answered. So let's
try to answer it real quick, because I don't know how many of you out there actually relate to this question, but maybe someday you will. So first of all, breastfeeding does cause a lot of hormonal changes that we know that temporarily suppress fertility. So we all hear that when you're breastfeeding, you're not going to be able to get pregnant, which is a bunch of BS. In the early stages of postpartum, like the first 6 weeks, no, but I mean, God, I don't know what woman would actually want to have sex in the first 6 weeks after giving birth. So it's usually at that time that like your midwife or your OBGYN will recommend to have some type of birth control on board. And usually they'll recommend like an IUD or something at 6 weeks. But if you know that you don't want to have any type of birth control, then it's definitely at that point that you're going to want to think about protection. And part of the reason why is because there has been a lot of research on what's called the interconception period, which is really ideally 18 months. So that means from birth of first baby to conception of another baby should be 18 months. And the reason why is because when you're breastfeeding, it takes up a lot of nutrients to feed yourself, and then of course to feed the baby. And so that's going to include things like fat soluble vitamins A, D, E, and K, B vitamins, folate, B12, B6, choline, iron, calcium, zinc, selenium, magnesium, iodine, the omega-3s like DHA and EPA, and also the amino acid glycine. And so when you're breastfeeding, your nutrient requirement goes way up. And if you get pregnant at the same time, then now your nutrient requirement is like for baby in the uterus and also baby on your boob. And so, and then of course there's you that you also want to make sure that you're taking care of. And so that's a lot to have to manage. And so if you don't have that gap, research shows that it lends towards premature birth, also towards more like preeclampsia and some other adverse pregnancy outcomes that we want to avoid in the medical system. And so that's why they recommend that. So if you do feel, I know some women definitely, you know, they want to have their babies really close together. So we're not saying we recommend that you do it, but if you're just going rogue and you want to do it, just make sure that you're on a really high quality prenatal supplement. It's very, very important that your diet is on point, that you're getting lots of nutrients. Maybe you do a smoothie in the morning with lots of high quality phytonutrients like spirulina and barley grass juice powder, things like that, that you get a lot of antioxidants on board and things that are going to provide you with those nutrients that we just listed out. And you can get more information on diet from our amazing Lily Nichols that wrote the book Real Food for Pregnancy. And you can also learn more about the exact nutrients that you'll need by going to our free course, How to Choose the Best Prenatal Supplements, which can be really helpful. Do you have anything else to add on that? And I'm going to talk about the month, the best time of the year to conceive.
No, I think that's pretty much it. I mean, I guess the ultimate answer to how many months should you wait before getting pregnant after breastfeeding? I mean, I guess the answer is you can technically get pregnant while you're still breastfeeding. You just want to consider that pregnancy spacing interval. And if you have the ability to wait at least 18 months between conception or birth of one baby and conception of another, that's ideal. But you can get pregnant while you're still breastfeeding. And if you've been paying attention to all of the nutrients that Dr. Haley just mentioned, all of the dietary considerations, you know, leading a healthy lifestyle, and you're feeling pretty good, you know, postpartum, you're not dealing with a whole bunch of health issues, you don't necessarily need to stop breastfeeding and then wait a certain number of months before you conceive your next baby. You can, if your cycle is normal and you're tracking and you're fertile and you're timing sex, like, you can get pregnant.
Yeah, totally. Really good point. And I would just say that if you did wait the 18 months and your baby's 18 months, by that time, usually, you know, they're really only taking a little bit of milk, and a lot of it's just comfort breastfeeding. And so your nutrient demand for that baby has gone way down. Right. But the first year really is going to be a high nutrient demand.
For sure. Yep.
Okay. So really interesting question is, when is the best time to like conceive around in the year? Is there a time in the year that you shouldn't conceive? So there's a little bit of research on this, and some studies show that birth defects risk is a little bit higher in babies that are conceived between April and July. But other studies show that babies conceived in late fall have a higher risk of asthma.
And there's like, so, there's a bunch of other studies too, where it's like, well, this is worse at this time and this is worse at this time. And so it's like, there's not like one magical
month. So what's that all about, right? Yeah. So we have concluded that likely it has to do with the nutrient status or possible environmental exposures to mother or potentially father at that time of conception or just during the pregnancy. So vitamin D is a really good example of this, because most people's vitamin D drops in the wintertime and they don't even know it. Because obviously they're not being exposed to as much sun. And low vitamin D, we talk a lot about this in our free course, but it does contribute to potential learning disabilities in children. It can contribute to infertility risk and also miscarriage and on and on. So, and then also being exposed to pesticides and herbicides in the summertime might be one of the reasons why the, you know, April, July thing has popped up in some studies. So we have an opinion that if you are eating a nutrient-dense diet, having good lifestyle habits, are mindful of your toxic exposures around you, so eating organically, staying away from plastics and things like that, then conception month is probably not going to matter too much for you.
Yep. Totally agree. All of those things are things that if you're struggling with some of those changes, we walk you through that in Fertile in 5. So that is definitely an option for you. If you're thinking like, oh, what should I be doing during this time to optimize all of those things? That is definitely a place where you can get more step-by-step information on that.
For sure. Okay. This one should be a quickie. The next question is, are there any tests to check what might be causing my facial hair growth?
Yes, a couple of options actually. So facial hair growth is often a sign of elevated androgens or male hormones. And facial hair growth in women is a symptom of hirsutism, which is basically signs and symptoms of elevated androgens. So your doctor could test your androgen hormones directly. So you could do a testosterone, either a free or a free and total testosterone test. You could also have your DHEA or DHEAS levels looked at to investigate this. If any of those are high, it is a possibility that elevated androgens is driving that facial hair growth. One of the most common root causes of elevated androgens is insulin resistance. And so in order to evaluate insulin resistance as a driving factor and something that you can actually do to start lowering those androgen hormones, I would recommend having your doctor evaluate your fasting glucose levels, fasting insulin, and hemoglobin A1C. Those are three markers that we use to assess blood sugar and insulin status in the body. And that would kind of give a more complete picture of what might be happening there. Another option, if your doctor suspects elevated androgens and insulin resistance, but those three blood sugar tests that I just mentioned come back normal, another option is to do something called a glucose tolerance test, and you can discuss the details of what that is and how it works with your doctor. So facial hair growth in women is a common symptom of PCOS, which is one of the most common causes of infertility in women. Polycystic ovarian syndrome. We've talked about PCOS a couple of times on the podcast in a few different episodes, one episode in the 20s and one in the 50s. Dr. Kevin Oberoi was the most recent interview that we did on PCOS, and we also did one with Dr. Laura Bryden. So look for those in the 20s and the 50s. I can't remember the exact episode off the top of my head for both of those, but those are great episodes to look deeper into if you're having some of those elevated androgen type symptoms, how to kind of look deeper into that, assess it further, and start addressing it.
Yeah, totally agree. Keep in mind also that hair growth on your face or places where you don't want it can also be genetics, depending on, you know, on ethnicity and things like that. And so keep that in mind when you're doing all the evaluation. And then also I would say that if you're doing blood tests, which most people do blood tests for the testosterone, total testosterone, when they're assessing for PCOS, those can come back normal. And usually a doctor won't order a DHT. And if you get a Dutch test done by Precision Analytical, that is going to be dried urine. That's something that we've talked about with Dr. Kerry Jones back in the 20s, would you say?
22. That one I do know.
She's good. Episode 22, and you can learn more about the Dutch test, but that will test the DHT as a, or the metabolites at least of testosterone, and let you know if, even though you have normal testosterone on a blood test, it may not be normal on the dried urine test, and that still could be driving the abnormal hair loss or hair growth.
Just the way that your DHEA is being metabolized in the body, there's like two major metabolites that you'll see on the Dutch test. One pathway of processing that DHEA is less androgenic and one is more. So like your DHEA might be normal, but you may be putting that hormone down a more androgenic pathway. And so that's really interesting too, is like even if blood tests come back normal and you still have some of those symptoms, it could still be androgens, but you just need a different evaluation.
Yep.
Good point. Okay, question 7 is also a lab testing type of question. And this is a little bit more of a specific situation. I included this just because of how common Hashimoto's thyroiditis is. So the question is, I would like to know why my thyroid lab show decreasing free T4 levels. I have Hashimoto's and I'm on WP thyroid, which is a glandular or a desiccated thyroid product, but my T4 keeps decreasing and my free T3 is increasing.
Yeah. So just to give you guys a little background, if you haven't heard, Hashimoto's thyroiditis is a autoimmune condition that is linked to hypothyroidism. And so that's when your thyroid stimulating hormone is above 2.5 when you're trying to conceive or are pregnant. And then also when you have positive thyroid antibodies. So antibodies like thyroglobulin or thyroid peroxidase antibody, those are going to be positive. And that means that your body is creating these antibodies by your immune system that's actually attacking your thyroid gland. So one of the treatments is desiccated thyroid hormone. This is a hormone that has both free T3 and T4 in the medication. And so what this person is asking is they're actually taking this particular medication, which is pretty common, especially in the alternative medicine community. Desiccated thyroid medications have, especially when levothyroxine is not working. So levothyroxine or Synthroid, you guys might recognize that, is just T4. So there's no T3 in it. And we leave it up to the body to convert that T4 into T3 as it sees fit. But that doesn't work for everybody, especially because sometimes, especially under chronic inflammation, the body isn't able to convert that T4 into T3. So they end up with a lot of T4 and they still have hypothyroidism and they still don't feel well. So what's happening here is likely is that the T3 is, the body is saying, oh, okay, I have plenty of T3. Or it might be actually over converting the T4 to T3. And so the T4 levels are dropping and then the T4 is increasing. This actually looks like a pretty, don't take this the wrong way, but it looks kind of like a common sense scenario to me, because when you're taking T3, your body is actually reacting almost too well, like overly well to that thyroid glandular. And it might be a situation where you may need to just try Synthroid or go back to the Synthroid or something, because you likely just aren't doing so well, or you're doing like too well where it's pushing your T3 too high and you're not maintaining a balanced T4 level. So if you were my patient, that's probably what I would do. Also, you can check into a possible cause, which this could be caused by insulin resistance or also elevated androgen levels. So that's something that you want to talk to your doctor about as well. So another thing that's interesting about Hashimoto's, it is an autoimmune condition. And what that means is you can go through flares. You could be going through a flare where your body is like, attack, 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 and it's attacking your thyroid gland. And it's just like dumping out a bunch of thyroid hormones that were stored in the gland. And so now you have T4 and T3 all over your bloodstream, and you might be sweating, have night sweats, heart palpitations, you're losing weight. And this can go on for maybe like 2 or 3 weeks. You don't know what's going on. And then all of a sudden you get depressed, you're super tired, you gain back that weight, you gain more weight, and you start having dry skin, your hair starts falling out. And like that, those swings from hyperthyroid to hypothyroid type of situations is very common in Hashimoto's, especially maybe like postpartum, or if you go through a really stressful life event. Those are things that can trigger flares. Most people, especially when it's really subtle, live in more of the hypothyroidism of Hashimoto's. But flares are common, especially when it's not being treated properly or at all. And then is there anything else I want to add? Yeah. So because it's an autoimmune condition, you do really need to find out what the root cause of this condition is. It's not just like, oh, you have hypothyroidism, here's a pill and you have to take it the rest of your life. Good luck. Bye. I mean, it means that you likely had something that happened that triggered this condition, such as an environmental exposure, some type of trauma, poor gut health, gut barrier dysfunction, so leaky gut, blood sugar imbalances, hidden infections. So all of those can be something that trigger this autoimmune condition, and you'll want to go ahead and get that fixed and get to the root cause of it, because not only is it causing you thyroid issues, but likely it's going to be causing you a whole lot of other issues. And that's why people who treat Hashimoto's with just medication and that's it, likely never feel better on just medication. And then they jump from medication to medication to medication to medication. And really, they're running around in circles and never getting to the root cause.
Yeah.
And that's why they never feel better.
And you might see different patterns in your thyroid that are all dysregulated, but you might see different patterns on different medications. And so, you know, taking something that has T4 and T3 in it might be a good strategy for some people. And it is more of a go-to as like a natural as opposed to a synthetic option that a lot of more holistic practitioners will choose, but it's important to evaluate whether or not that's actually right in your specific situation. If you look like you might be one of those people who tends to overconvert T4 to T3 for whatever reason, whether that's insulin resistance, elevated androgens, or some other cause that might be leading to that, a medication that contains T3 might not be the right choice for you. And then with Hashimoto's, with those flares and periods of more like remission and periods of flare that Dr. Haley was talking about, it makes it really hard to be on a single consistent dose of thyroid medication that's going to work for you the same way all the time. And so you may see some swings month over month.
Yeah. The last thing I was going to add, oh my gosh, I was thinking about it right when you were talking. What was it?
I ruined it.
Kristen, you ruined it. You ruined it. Okay, distract me. We'll go back to it.
Shall I distract you by moving on to the next question?
Yes, that's exactly what I was thinking. How about I read it? Okay. Okay,
you read it.
I was wondering, post miscarriage, do you have any key tips or suggestions on how to get your period back and regulated?
Okay, this is a big question. There's a lot that could potentially be at play here.
It was about trying to conceive and pregnancy and thyroid hormone. Most, I would say the vast majority of doctors out there, they're always going to want you to be on levothyroxine because they know it's safe in pregnancy and they know they're just way more familiar with it than desiccated thyroid hormone. And there's not very many studies at all on desiccated thyroid hormone and trying to conceive in pregnancy. So if you can somehow work on the root cause, try to get everything stable, get the inflammation down, and get on levothyroxine or Synthroid while you're trying to conceive, that's probably going to do yourself some good and your doctor will be very happy.
Much happier.
Okay, that was it.
Okay. So back to question 8, I'll repeat it. It was, I was wondering, post miscarriage, do you have any key tips or suggestions on how to get your period back and regulated? So the first thing I want to mention here is that it can take up to 3 months for your cycle to return to normal after a loss. Now, this isn't necessarily typical. Most of the time, 4 to 6 weeks is the time frame for your cycle to return. But if it's still been within 3 months and it hasn't come back normal, you might want to kind of wait for that 3 month time period to be up before you start, you know, panicking or worrying or going to see your doctor. And they'll likely tell you the same. If you go in and want to investigate this before 3 months, they'll probably say, okay, we'll start being concerned at 3 months. So if it hasn't returned within that 3 month time period, my strategy is usually to look deeper into how is overall health doing, because we can often find a lot of clues as to what might be going on with your cycle. I mean, we have to remember that your menstrual cycle and how regulated it is and how healthy it is really a reflection of how healthy your body is overall. And so when we see an issue with the menstrual cycle or it's not returning after a loss, we want to look into things like, is your thyroid functioning well? Are you sufficient in key nutrients that are required for your body to have a menstrual cycle? Are you anemic, for instance? Do you have, you know, low vitamin D or other nutrient deficiencies that could be playing a role here? Is there some other type of like immune stress going on or a detoxification issue, something like that? But some of the first labs that you can look at to get a better sense of where your overall health is at are the same labs that I request on pretty much all of my fertility clients coming in as new clients. So a full thyroid panel is a great idea. When we say full thyroid panel, we mean not just TSH. We mean TSH plus free T4 and free T3, as well as thyroid antibodies at the very least. I also include total T4 and T3, as well as reverse T3 on the panels that I run. But if you can at least get your TSH, free T4, free T3, and antibodies, that's a great start. Complete blood count with differential. The differential just means the percentage breakdown between the different types of white blood cells. A comprehensive metabolic panel that assesses liver and kidney function. And we can also find some more subtle imbalances in a metabolic panel that would be more nutritionally driven and give us some clues as to like digestive function or maybe like subtle congestion or detoxification issues in the liver. Also, request a lipid panel. An iron and total iron binding capacity, so an iron panel. A ferritin level, which tests stored iron in the blood. So the iron and TIBC and the ferritin are all going to be looking at is iron deficiency anemia, potentially an issue that could be contributing to lack of menstrual cycle. And then blood sugar markers. So you'll get a fasting glucose on your comprehensive metabolic panel, but I also request an insulin, a fasting insulin, and a hemoglobin A1C. A vitamin D level. A homocysteine level, which assesses for B vitamin sufficiency. So you can actually be deficient in Bs, and that's another type of anemia that you can have. Or if your homocysteine is elevated, that can be inflammatory in the body. And on that note of inflammation, I also request a high sensitivity C-reactive protein. And that helps assess whether or not there's like an inflammatory fire burning somewhere in the body that we need to track down. And so I do recommend having these evaluated from more of a functional perspective. In functional medicine and nutrition, we just look at labs differently than we do in conventional medicine. The point of these labs isn't necessarily to like diagnose you with a specific medical condition, especially for me, since I'm not a doctor. What I'm looking at in these labs is more of those subtle nutritional or functional type of imbalances that could throw things off enough in your body to create an issue with your menstrual cycle and fertility. And so these can be great indicators for how we can intervene with things like diet, lifestyle, and supplements to kind of get things balanced back out and have your menstrual cycle return, which would be the ideal scenario. Another thing to consider is having hormones evaluated. And I prefer to do this with functional testing, like a Dutch test or a salivary or dried urine cycle mapping test that shows us what your estrogen and progesterone are doing throughout the cycle. But I think a Dutch test for someone who's not cycling is a better choice just because it gives us a little bit more information and it can help us understand what your methylation activity is like. Do you maybe have some liver congestion or something like that going on? Is your testosterone elevated? You know, is your cortisol really elevated? What might be causing those imbalances that are leading to a lack of cycle? And then I just want to point out that with miscarriage, you know, if you're trying to get your period back after a loss, a loss is devastating. That is a hugely emotional event, and grief and chronic stress that can be caused by miscarriage can really have a profound impact on your menstrual cycle. And so I do think it's important, in addition to doing some of this underlying health investigation, just to really make sure that you are processing and working through the emotional trauma of that loss. We talked, I don't remember what episode it was, but Dr. Anna Kabeka, she shares a story about her fertility being thrown completely off track, basically ending up in early menopause after the death of her toddler son, and how that just completely messed up her hormones and she ended up losing her cycle and being told that there was no way that she was going to be able to conceive again, that she was essentially in menopause. And so most people aren't in that severe of a situation, but that can happen and it can be having an impact on whether or not your cycle is returning normally. So for sure, consider that and maybe like an emotional healing type of modality to work on that. And then the only other thing I want to add is that if you did happen to have a DNC procedure to remove pregnancy tissue from the uterus, if you weren't able to pass everything, naturally and they had to actually go in and kind of scrape and get that out, there is a small chance that scar tissue can form after that procedure. And if there's scar tissue in the uterus, that can prevent your uterine lining from being able to build up, that can prevent your cycle from returning normally. So if you are concerned about that, talk to your doctor about that and they can do a hysteroscopy or a specialized ultrasound to look further into that.
That's perfect. You did a great job answering that question.
Oh, thanks.
Heck no.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yes, you did it.
Oh, I think this next one is me too. This is a short one.
It is. Yeah.
It's everyone's
it's all about pea protein. So could peas / pea protein be stopping me from getting pregnant, as it was researched in the 60s as being a natural contraceptive and 60% effective in doing so? That question was worded oddly, but just go ahead.
Yeah.
Pea protein and peas.
Could pea protein be interfering with hormones or preventing conception? It is true that there was research from back in the 60s. It's old research. As far as I can tell from reading through the studies myself, it sounds pretty legitimate. It looks pretty legitimate that there is a connection there. I think the original purpose of studying it for that is they were actually considering using it in the development of some type of contraceptive medication. And so here's kind of my take on pea protein. I don't love it, honestly, as a source of protein to rely on really heavily. I don't have an issue with like the occasional use of a pea protein powder, but I typically don't recommend pea protein powder on its own, especially if you're having like multiple smoothies a day and you're adding it to a lot of things to try to get extra protein. This is an issue that I see really commonly on people that are trying to increase their protein on a plant-based diet. And instead of opting for eating whole food sources of protein or in lieu of eating animal products, if they're eliminating those, they'll turn to something like this, like an organic pea protein, just to try to up the macronutrient percentage of protein in their diet. So the amino acid profile of pea protein is just not, it does not have the same quality and absorption and utilization in the body as, like, for instance, a high quality animal protein does. And so I do really consider it an inferior source of protein to some of the other whole food sources that you consume in the diet. So that's one reason I don't love it, aside from the potential, you know, contraceptive issue. Peas are also a highly allergenic food for some people, and legumes may cause issues for some people that have problems with their gut and their digestive system. So it's typically not my go-to recommendation. And so just given all of those things together, along with the research that shows that it has some contraceptive properties, I don't recommend pea protein as a standalone protein powder. If it happens to be in a plant-based protein powder that also includes other sources of protein, like rice protein, or like, you know, I think there's like pumpkin hemp. Protein, hemp, and some others like that, then I'd say fine, as long as it's not the primary source of protein. And like, I like some plant-based protein options, like Garden of Life has a good one called raw organic protein. That's not just pea. It has pea and a couple of other things in it as well. And I will sometimes recommend that to people who are looking for a plant-based source. But I wouldn't recommend relying on large amounts of pea protein to try to round out your daily protein needs. And for some people, depending on the client, I just might recommend avoiding it completely. So it's best to focus on getting protein from real food.
Agreed. Yeah. I have nothing to add.
Cool. Well, we made it to question 10. And Dr. Haley, you're going to take this one, but I will go ahead and read it. I have brown spotting between ovulation and my period, sometimes starting only a few days after ovulation. What could be causing this?
So there's multiple reasons that could be causing spotting between periods. One big reason that we've talked about extensively, I believe just recently, didn't we? With like Dr. Carrie Jones, two weeks ago.
Yeah, that was all about progesterone. And then
all about low progesterone. And so low progesterone basically what that means is that and you could get more information in the episode because we really dive into it, which is great. But after ovulation, that follicle turns into the corpus luteum and starts producing progesterone. Those are going to be coming from luteal cells, and depending on the quality of that follicular development, that corpus luteum might not be so strong. It might be weakly producing progesterone, and then, you know, it gives it a good gung ho, and then it just kind of falls off. And when it starts to fall below the limit that your uterus really appreciates on a day-to-day basis in the luteal phase, then it's going to start shedding that lining. And so that could be the brown spotting that you're seeing. I am a little concerned that it seems like even a few days after ovulation seems like a really long period to spot, because our luteal phase really should be 12 to 14 days. So that means you're spotting for about 10 days or so. And so that really makes me want to tell you to go see your doctor about that. And it could be something more anatomical. It could be something that's coming from your cervix. So this often happens after you have intercourse, that your cervix gets abrased and it actually starts to bleed after intercourse.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so that could be a sign of maybe dysbiosis in the microbiome or your vaginal microbiome, which is causing kind of that friable cervix. And that could cause spotting. That makes me even more suspicious, since you said after ovulation, if you're trying to conceive, then that means that you had intercourse. So that's one thing to check out. You also might have like a polyp or a fibroid, or, you know, there's lots of other reasons that you might be spotting. If it's just really light brown type of spotting, you may also just want to, you know, maybe you just don't really have a very strong endometrial lining that's being built during that follicular phase and into the luteal phase. And I know that my abdominal massage has actually been really helpful for that. It brings blood flow and lymph flow into your uterus, into your ovaries. And that sometimes, just that alone, can really help the lining of your endometrium and reduce your chances of spotting in your luteal phase.
Yeah, I agree.
All I got.
Yeah, low progesterone for sure, look into, but definitely don't rule out anatomical causes, especially having spotting that early on. What will happen with some people, and what used to happen with me in my cycle, is I would spot early on and then it would stop and then it would kind of start again. But I would also notice like hormonal and temperature fluctuations in my chart when that was happening as well. So like if my temp in the luteal phase, like it had risen and it was staying really high and then it drops for a day, and I might notice that I spot that day. And there are things that can affect the sensitivity and the receptivity of your uterine lining to progesterone. Inflammation can cause that. Elevated cortisol can cause that. If you notice that like you eat certain foods in your luteal phase and the next day you end up spotting, like you can start to identify some patterns to see like, maybe is this hormonal or might it be related more to an anatomical cause? But definitely if you're noticing that, have it checked out with your doctor. Just rule out anything that might need to be taken care of, because all of the things that Dr. Haley mentioned that could be at play, like infections or growths or abnormalities with the cervix, a fibroid, a polyp, those are all things that you would want to address prior to conceiving anyway. So it's a good idea to have those ruled out.
Yeah, totally agree. And you made a really good point about tracking your cycle. That could be super helpful in that part of your cycle to figure out, is your temperature dropping and does it relate to the spotting that's happening?
Yeah, for sure. All right. We made it through 10 questions in what I think was a reasonable amount of time today. So right within that hour that we typically try to stay within. So we will let you guys go for this week. But we hope that you enjoyed this episode, and we will see you for another Q&A episode toward the beginning of May. Please, 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 please send me your questions. I love hearing from you guys. I do tend to write really detailed responses. So if you're really looking to learn more about these topics, I would love to help you out with that.